that there should be women in the church. Now that says about everything, doesn't it? I think I can sit down. Any questions? Well, wouldn't it be great if it was that simple? But it's not. There's a lot of serious stuff at stake here. I do have an outline of all this material. It's being prepared right now. And it should be available by break time, someone said. I'm not sure why it wasn't run already. Maybe because it was 20 pages long, it just looked too ominous. You think I can get through 20 pages of material in this time? I don't know. I've done it in an hour. Maybe I can do it in two. But I skip a lot. But if we have it printed for you, at least you'll have it to take back with you, study in more detail. I have a title for this lesson. It's called Feminist Hermeneutics, Theology Ex Nihilo. There's no question this is one of the most serious controversies facing our churches, namely this issue of the role of women in the family and in the church. The traditional role, which most of us grew up with and probably most of us here still accept, is this: that in the family, the husband is the head of the wife in the sense that he is the leader or the one in authority. And in the church, the only men, or only men, fill the roles of preacher and elder, since women are not permitted to teach men or have authority over men. That is the traditional view. But this traditional view is being seriously challenged today. Throughout Christendom, in both liberal and conservative circles, and this includes the conservative circle, or conservative wing of the Restoration Movement, the one of which we're a part, a new view of the role of women is being widely taught and widely accepted. We might call it the revisionist view, or just the feminist view. It says this: that in the home, husband and wife have a mutual partnership, with neither one being the leader or the one in authority. And in the church, gender, whether you're male or female, has nothing to do with who fills any particular role. There should be no role distinctions between men and women. But whatever men can do, women can do also. And so women should be accepted as preachers and elders in our local churches. This is very definitely a view that's gaining more and more ground among us in high places and in low places. And even if we ourselves do not hold to this view, and our churches represented here do not agree with this, we need to know why so many people are holding this view, and what's the basis for their accepting it. And that's the kind of thing we're going to be looking at here today. Now, I want to say this with regard to this feminist view. I realize that the people who hold it are very serious and very sincere, and I realize that one reason that they have come to this view is because there are a lot of women who feel very hurt that they're not accepted in the leadership of the church. They feel they have talents, abilities that they can use, and they're being excluded from using them. And so that they feel a sense of hurt. They feel that justice is not being done. And I want to say that I'm sensitive to these kinds of feelings. And so I don't present this critique lightly or superficially or with any malice or hostility. Also, anybody who knows me well knows that I don't defend the traditional view of anything just because it's the traditional view. I don't hesitate to abandon traditional ideas or practices if it seems to me they can't be justified by Scripture. And I guess I have abandoned some. My only concern in offering this critique is the defense of truth, the defense of sound doctrine concerning this matter. And so with this in mind, I'll now say, what's going on here? Does anybody know what that noise is? Good thinking. But my hand's not in my pocket all that time. Okay. Boy, I'm glad you all knew what that was. I thought there was something under there about to get me. I was ready for something to spring up and bite me on the leg here. Anyway. Now, wait a minute. What's going on here? That's as far as I'm going. That must have been it. That was it. All right. Well, at least we got it solved. All right. Here's my thesis. My contention is that the traditional view is the true view. Am I on now? Lost it to get all together now? Well, we're slaves to this, aren't we? The new feminist view is totally without foundation in the Word of God. Totally. And more specifically, my thesis is this, that the feminist hermeneutic, that is, the feminist attempt to find this view somewhere in the Bible, is a case of theology ex nihilo. Now, if you know what those words mean, then you catch my drift. This is an allusion to the Bible doctrine of the creation of the world. We say that when God created the universe, he created it ex nihilo, which are Latin words that mean out of nothing. He created the world out of nothing, ex nihilo. We also say that he created it as an act of will. He wanted the universe, so he just willed it into existence. As Revelation 4:11 says, because of thy will, they existed and were created. Now, I'm making a play on those words, ex nihilo, here. It's my contention that those who teach and defend this new feminism have brought this view into existence ex nihilo, literally out of nothing. The alleged biblical basis for this feminist view is non-existent. It has been created out of thin air. Now, I'm not saying that feminists themselves are aware of this, consciously anyway, or that they're doing something deliberately here with intent to deceive. That's not the point at all. On the contrary, they're quite convinced that the view is really taught in the Bible. So my point is that they're finding this view in the Bible. The fact that they believe they find this view in the Bible is a sheer act of will. They want to find it there so badly that they call into existence that which does not exist. Now, I could give a number of examples of this, of a more detailed nature, some small items, such as, for example, the feminist view that when God created Adam and Eve, he created the male and the female simultaneously. And the Bible actually is supposed to say that in Genesis 1:27. Here, for example, is one feminist book. It says, quote, "In Genesis 1, male and female are said to be created simultaneously," unquote. Another one says that we find the statement in Genesis 1 that male and female were created simultaneously. Now, if you've read Genesis 1, you may be wondering where that is in Genesis 1. Well, all they're referring to is the statement in Genesis 1:27, which says, "And God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them." Now, you see, it doesn't say anything about the order of creation there whatsoever. It just says he created the male and the female. But in order to escape the implications that the male was created first, the feminist says they were created simultaneously, and that Genesis 1 actually says that. Well, obviously it doesn't say that. And in fact, that idea goes directly against Genesis 2, and it goes against 1 Timothy 2:13. This is an example of creation or theology ex nihilo. You see, just creating their view out of nothing. Another example on a very limited scale is the feminist view that Jesus became incarnate specifically to set women free from their subordinate role, the one foisted on them by Genesis 3. And this is why he became a human being, in order to set women free. And it's asserted, to reinforce this, that the New Testament writers always refer to Jesus with the generic term anthropos, which means human being and not male, just means human rather than male, and that's supposed to show that the incarnation was gender neutral, you see. That even though Jesus had the physical appearance of a male, he's always called anthropos to include male and female. And they say the New Testament writers always refer to him as anthropos. And I have examples of that here too. Well, you see, technically, that's almost true, that the New Testament writers, that would be like Matthew and Mark and Luke and John and Paul, used the word anthropos to refer to Jesus. I say almost true because the Apostle John in Revelation 12, verse 5, describes Jesus with another Greek word, one which means specifically a male. It's the Greek word arsen. But that's not the most serious problem here. The most serious problem is that the feminists who say that Jesus is always described by the New Testament writers as anthropos, which, as I've already said, is not correct, what they imply there is that is the universal way the New Testament speaks of Jesus. But the technicality is, they say, the New Testament writers. What they ignore, and I can't believe that they don't know this. I can't believe they don't know this. If they don't know it, then they haven't done their research very well. And if they know it and yet word their argument so as to obscure it, that means they're deceiving us or trying to deceive us. But what they don't say is that some of the inspired speakers quoted in the Bible do use the Greek word for male to describe Jesus. In fact, you have John the Baptist in John 1:30 referring to Jesus with the Greek word aner, which means male. You have the Apostle Peter in Acts 2, verse 22, and you have the Apostle Paul in Acts 17:31 referring to Jesus as a male. I see, feminists don't like that. They want him to be called just anthropos because that's the generic term and it does not agree, or that's what would support their view. So they just totally ignore what goes against their view. Well, those are some small technicalities, and I just want to mention those by way of introduction. I'm not going to concentrate on small technicalities here. I'm going to refer to what I think are the five main pillars of feminist theology. The five main supports of the feminist view of the role of women, which according to the feminists are found in Scripture, but which I believe are totally without foundation in the Bible or anywhere else. No, I'm not. No. Billy Graham once said there's a demon in every audio system. And I think he's probably right, except when the liberals are speaking. Then they know. We tell ourselves that to comfort ourselves, to persuade ourselves, you know, that we have the right view. I'm talking about the five main supports of the feminist position, which they claim are based on fact, based on the Bible. My contention is they're totally without foundation in the Bible. They're created from nothing. Now, I'm going to tell you what these five main pillars are, and I trust that we will have this material in our hands before you leave. But here they are. I will quote them. And I'm quoting them as the feminist would express them. First of all, quote, the concept of mutual submission taught in Ephesians 5:21 negates or disproves the idea of a subordinate role for the wife in relation to her husband, unquote. That's the feminist view, that there is no such thing as submission of the wife to the husband without a mutual submission of the husband to the wife. Personally, I'm convinced that the idea of mutual submission is a myth. It does not exist. A second main view of feminists, quote, the word head, as it's used to describe the husband's or the man's role in the family, means origin or source. It never means leader or one in authority, unquote. Now that, again, is to try to disprove the idea that the husband is to have the leadership in the home. And they say that's not what the word head means in the Greek language. The view they present is that the Greek word kephale, which is the word for head, actually means source or origin and has nothing to do with leadership. As I understand it, there's not a shred of evidence that this is true, but there is evidence that the word does mean authority when it's used in a figurative sense, of course. That's the only thing we're concerned with. Here's a third feminist argument, and this and the next one both have to do with 1 Timothy 2:12. You remember 1 Timothy 2:12, where Paul says, I do not allow a woman to teach or have authority over a man. According to feminists, Paul's prohibition of women as teachers of men in this passage was intended to be limited to the church at Ephesus only, and even there was intended to be temporary, not permanent. So the idea that I do not at this time in this place allow women to teach men, that's not meant to be an eternal principle. My view is that the so-called facts that are used to support this key feminist argument are literally manufactured out of thin air. The fourth feminist myth has also to do with that verse. It says that the kind of authority that Paul does not allow women to exercise there in 1 Timothy 2:12 is not just plain ordinary authority, but a sinful, domineering kind of authority. Again, my opinion is that the evidence for this key idea is totally non-existent. The last pillar of feminism is that Paul's statement in Galatians 3:28 was intended to erase all role distinctions between men and women for all times. And this basic feminist, in my opinion though, this basic feminist contention ignores the context of Paul's statement as the thing that determines what he actually means. So those are the five key feminist ideas. One having to do with mutual submission, one having to do with head meaning source, one saying that the prohibition to teach of women to teach men was limited by the circumstances in Ephesus, and that the authority that Paul's talking about there is sinful authority and not regular authority, and that's why he prohibits it. And finally, that Galatians 3:28 opens the doors wide for women to do anything that men can do. The rest of what I'm doing here is a more detailed look at these five ideas. First of all, let's look at the feminist myth of mutual submission. The feminist myth of mutual submission. Now, there are six New Testament passages that teach that the woman should be in submission to her husband. These six passages are 1 Corinthians 14:34. These are all in the outline when you get it. Ephesians 5:21-24, Colossians 3:18, 1 Timothy 2:11, Titus 2:5, and 1 Peter 3:1-5. Wives, be submissive to your husbands. You know that passage. If any of you husbands don't know that passage, you probably ought to go look it up. Along with the one that says, husbands, love your wives. Now, what does this word mean? Be in submission to your husband. The Greek word is hupotasso. And Don Nash, who has been teaching or did teach at KCC for decades, an expert in Greek, says this word means, quote, to place under in authoritative rank as a private under a centurion under a captain, or a captain under a general. So be submissive would be like a private being submissive to a sergeant, that is, acknowledging the authority of the sergeant and following the leadership of the sergeant. That's what the word means. And actually, there's nobody that tries to dispute this. This is one case where the word is so unambiguous that even feminists don't try to argue about what the word means or doesn't mean. One thing that we should note is that never in the Bible is this term or any like it used to apply to the husband or to the man. See, the man or the husband is never told to be in submission to the woman or to his wife. It's never used in that sense. It's always used in reference to women being submissive to their husbands. Now, in view of this, how in the world can feminists avoid what seems to be the clear implication of submission on the part of women? See, that they don't want that, and they won't have it. But how can they avoid it? Well, everything is made to hinge on one specific verse. Everything is made to hinge on what is said in Ephesians 5, verse 21. And this is the way you'll see it in the literature as they lambast the men. And the non-feminists who emphasize submission, they will say, you people have never read Ephesians 5:21. This is the verse that begins the section on wives, be subject to your husbands. But what does verse 21 say? Ephesians 5:21, it says, be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Be subject to one another. Now the feminist reads this verse and says, oh, good. Here's a way of understanding it that agrees with my feminist view. And that is the idea of mutual submission. Now, mutual submission means this. In any pair where the first member is required to submit to the second member of the pair, it is assumed that the second member is required to submit to the first member also. So that there is never any one-way submission. If the wife is to be in submission to her husband, then the husband must also be in submission to the wife, even if that is not specifically stated. Simply because of verse 21, which says, be subject to one another. Wives, be subject to your husbands. And even though it doesn't say it, you've got to take it to mean, husbands, be subject to your wives. And to the feminists, that takes the edge off. And they say, well, sure, I'll be submissive to you, but you have to be submissive to me too. So it's like a standoff. And this is applied especially here in Ephesians 5:22 and following. Of course, verse 21 is the verse we're talking about. And then verse 22 says, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband's the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, and so on. Husbands, love your wives like Christ loved the church. See, verse 22 specifically applies it to the wife. Verse 21 says, be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Wives, be subject to your own husbands. Then using this principle of mutual submission, they assume that it's got to apply to the husband also, even though not specifically stated. And if you point out then that verse 25 says for husbands to love their wives, not be submissive to them, they simply say, well, that's how the husband submits himself to the wife. You see, that's the explanation of submission on the part of the husband. So they feel that they have negated all these verses that say to the women or to the wives to be submissive by appealing to the mutual submission. Now, are we going to take questions and answers in as we go along or what? Doesn't matter to me. You have a question?
I just wonder about the verse that husbands love your wife, give yourself up for them. They say that that would give the wife to the husband too.
Well, no, not that I know of. But that is used to describe how the husband is supposed to submit to his wife. And I would say that they would agree. It's not emphasized, but I'm sure they would say there's nothing wrong with that, and probably it ought to apply that way. That would be my opinion, even though I've not seen it said specifically like that.
What did they do then in verse 24, where it says, church submit to Christ, and wives submit to your husbands, as church submit to Christ? Is there a mutual submission there then?
Yes, you see, that's why I need to go on, because I'll answer most of your questions. I'll tell you, after I get through with the mutual submission thing, we'll have questions and see, because I might be answering your questions as I go. And that really gets to the heart of the problem with the mutual submission idea. And that is in this passage in Ephesians 5:21, where Paul says, be subject to one another. The examples that he brings out are not just husband and wife, but also three other pairs are mentioned in this passage as well. There is the husband-wife relationship, but there's also a relationship between three other pairs. So if you're going to be consistent, you're going to have to apply the mutual submission idea to these other pairs also. Are feminists willing to do this? The answer is yes, they are. They're willing to do it. They recognize they have to do it to get it to apply to husbands and wives. They have to apply it to these other pairs as well. Now, what are these other pairs in this context? It goes on through chapter 6. Down in chapter 6, the next pair after husbands and wives is children and parents. Children, obey your parents. See, that's parallel to wives, be subject to your husbands. That's one way of being submissive. The next way of being submissive is, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Do feminists say then that parents are supposed to submit to their children? Yes, they will say that. And they say that's what verse 4 means when it says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. That's how fathers submit to their children. But it's a submission. The next pair is slaves and masters. Slaves are specifically taught to, verse 5, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh. And then he gives explicit instruction about the proper attitude that should accompany this obedience. Do feminists say then that masters should submit to their slaves? Yes, they do. They will go on and say that. Yes, they have to, you see, because the principle of mutual submission makes it necessary. Well, what's the other pair? This is the one that was mentioned in the question here. The other pair in this context is Christ and the church. And this is back in chapter 5. This is what Paul uses as the model for the relation between the husband and the wife. See, the wife is said, is told to submit to her husband as the church is subject to Christ. Verse 24. And no one can deny that the church should be subject to Christ. But the principle of mutual submission requires that the feminist say Christ should also be subject to the church. Just as the church submits to Christ, Christ submits to the church. Now, are the feminists willing to say that? Yes, they are. They are willing to bite the bullet and to plunge in and affirm that Christ submits to the church. Why? They have to. They have to support the idea of mutual submission as they understand it in the home. And even though this is never stated in this passage or anywhere else, it is simply asserted because this concept of mutual submission requires it. Now, what this text does say is that Christ loves the church and he gave himself as a sacrifice for the church. He sanctifies the church. He cleanses the church. He nourishes it and he cherishes it. Well, the feminists say, well, see, that means he is submitting to the church. That's what submission is all about. That is the way Christ submits to the church. Now, even though it's probably obvious, I will now state why I believe this feminist concept of mutual submission has been created out of nothing. That is a fact. It's a fact that if mutual submission is the point of 5:21, be subject to one another in the fear of Christ, then, folks, you have to apply it, not just to husbands and wives, but to children and parents, masters and slaves, and even Christ and the church. And I believe that here is where, if you really stop and think about it, the principle absolutely breaks down. When you read what Paul says here, and even just think about it slightly even, you can see that that is not his point, this mutual submission idea. And it becomes very clear that this mutual submission is an idea, I believe, born out of desire and desperation, created ex nihilo to avoid the clear implications of this term submission. See, even when you apply it to parents and children, or slaves and masters, can anyone really think that even in the Christian dispensation that parents are supposed to submit to their children? That is a crazy idea. It is a crazy idea. But when you try to apply this to Christ and the church, especially, I think here's where this idea of mutual submission shatters back into this nothingness from which it came. There is absolutely nothing in the term itself or in the context of Ephesians 5 that justifies saying that Christ is submissive to the church. Now, you can talk about Christ sacrificing himself for the church and sanctifying the church and nourishing the church and loving the church, but to say that all that is a form of submission stretches the meaning of that word beyond all reason and recognition. It changes the meaning of the word totally. Now, certainly these are things that Christ has done for the church. But here's the question. When somebody does something for someone else, does that mean he has submitted to the authority of that person or submitted to that person in any sense? Not in the sense of hupotasso, folks. It has nothing to do with the idea of submission. What does it have to do with? It has to do with love. And that's the point. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And if you love someone, then love will sacrifice. Love will nourish and cherish. But that's different from submission. And to try to equate these ideas is theology ex nihilo. What is the point of Ephesians 5:21 then, when it says, be subject to one another? The context ought to show us, as the traditional view has held, that this is not a mutual submission, not a two-way subordination of each to each. Rather, I think it's this idea. Paul means, submit yourselves to one another where your circumstances call for it. If you are a wife, submit yourself to your husband. If you are a husband and wife, submit yourself to the elders in the church. Elders, husbands, wives, children, everybody, submit yourselves to the civil authorities. Children, submit yourselves to your parents. Slaves, submit yourselves to masters. These are not two-way submissions. They're simply saying that there are several different kinds of relationship that involve submission. And if you're in one of those relationships, submit yourself. The roles of the two sides of each pair are not mutual or reciprocal, as they like to use the word. They're complementary. That is, one side of the pair does one thing, the other side does something else, and they go together. The wife submits to and respects her husband, while the husband, in his role as head, loves and cares for his wife. But these are not the same thing. They're different things that complement each other. This is how he put it in Colossians 3:18. It's the same thing. Wives, be subject to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. That's a summary of Ephesians. Wives, be subject to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. Those are not identical. They complement each other. See also 1 Peter 3, verses 1 to 7. Where Peter does the same thing. In verses 1 through 6, he says, wives, be submissive to your own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him Lord. But then in verse 7, he gives the other side of the coin when he says, husbands, likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman. There's nothing here about mutual submission, but a complementary relationship. I like to refer to 1 Peter 3, 1 to 7 as the passages that feminists love to ignore. They really don't say much about this passage because it certainly goes against the idea of mutuality as the whole Bible itself does. And anybody who doubts this, I just say to them, think about the implications of this mutual submission for Christ and the church. Do you really believe that the New Testament teaches that Christ in any sense submits to the church? I cannot see how anybody would ever have come to that idea except through desperation. The church is a model for wives when it comes to submission. Christ is a model for husbands showing them how to exercise their headship in this spirit of love and self-sacrifice. Christ is the head of the church, but He is a head who loves His church. And because He loves it, He sacrifices Himself and sanctifies the church and nourishes the church. These are expressions of love, not submission. So my conclusion is that submission is not mutual, it's a one-way street that is balanced by love and self-sacrifice. Now, do you have any questions about the mutual submission idea? I'm not trying to discourage questions. Don't misunderstand me here. It's an amen, huh?
Amen.
All right. Okay. All right, we have about 7 or 8 minutes before break time. Let me get started on the next point. This is the feminist myth that the word head, when applied to the husband is the head of the wife, that the word head means origin and not leader. All right, that's the feminist view. Very, very common. I'm not trying to give you any weird or out of the... Well, you might think they're all weird. But, I mean, in this discussion, these are not fringe arguments. These are central arguments for the feminist. And this second one is the idea that the word head does not mean leader, it means origin. See, Ephesians 5:23 says, the husband is the head of the wife. Now, traditionally, we have understood that word head to mean leader or one in authority. It is the Greek word kephale. Some of you who have studied Greek will recognize that kephale. What's the literal meaning of kephale? The literal meaning is this knot on top of your shoulders. See, the head. That's the way we use the word head most of the time when we use it. So here we're talking about one of the figurative senses of the word. And obviously the figurative sense is going to be much less frequent, but it's there. When the word kephale is used metaphorically or figuratively, what does it mean? Traditionally, we've said that it means the one who leads. He is the head. One reason for saying this is because it corresponds so nicely with the idea of submission. The wife submits to the husband who is the head. And this is called a hierarchical relationship. That is, it's a hierarchy, one having a higher position than the other in a sense, like, as we said, a major is over a captain or something like that. So the traditional view is the husband is the head in the sense of a leader, and the wife submits to her head. Well, that's a pretty anti-feminist thing to say. So what do feminists do with this word head? How can they keep on asserting the idea of mutual submission when right here in the context of the mutual submission concept, as they think they see it, Paul clearly says the husband is to be the head of the wife. How do they avoid that? They avoid it by completely redefining the meaning of the term head. I mean completely redefining it. Now, first of all, there are two steps to this. First, they declare that this term kephale, when it was used in a figurative or metaphorical sense in the Greek-speaking world, that it never, ever meant chief or leader or one in authority. They say we have just been mistaken all these centuries to think that that idea or that meaning is part of the Greek word kephale. It never means that. Here's a couple of quotes on that. Here's a feminist who says, quote, the idea of authority was not a recognized meaning of kephale in Greek. And here's another. This is Scott Barchi, one of our own. He says, in ordinary Greek usage, the word kephale never means head in the sense of director, boss, or decision maker. So that's the first part of their argument, that it never means one in authority. The second part is they assert that kephale was often used by Greeks to mean source or origin. As one feminist couple says, this was one of the common Greek meanings of kephale. Common Greek meanings, source or origin. Barchi says, in Greek usage, this term bears the metaphorical meaning source or origin rather than chief or boss. And he says this usage is common, well documented, and demonstrated in the Greek. Although it's not really clear how this is supposed to be understood, this is supposed to be what the word head means when it's applied to husbands. The husbands are the source of the wives. Now you tell me, I don't know what that would mean. And Christ is the source of the church. Now we can understand that a little better than we can to say the husband is the source or origin of the wife. I dare say there is no really clear way. The question is simply whether or not that's what the word head or kephale is intending to imply. Let me mention this, that if you're a feminist and you're trying to make your point that the word head does not mean leader or one in authority, but rather means origin, then you will have to give it this meaning in every case in the New Testament where it refers to Christ and the church. There are several passages where the New Testament says Christ is the kephale of the church. He is the head of the church. Does that mean in every case that he is the source? Well, it never means he is the leader of the church. It never means he is the one who is over the church. But rather, in most cases at least, it would be he is the origin. For example, let me mention Ephesians 1, verse 22. Ephesians 1:22 says this: He, that is Christ, put all things in subjection under his feet, or rather, God put all things in subjection under the feet of Christ, and gave him as head over all things to the church. Got that? Gave him as head over all things to the church. How does Scott Barchi say that ought to be translated? He says you should translate this that Christ is the source for all things for the church. And that's the way he translates it. The source for all things for the church. Again, it's a question of being consistent. If you're going to say that the husband is not the leader of the wife, then you can't use that meaning when it applies to Christ either. We've reached our 3 o'clock break time. When we come back, we will respond to this. Do we have outlines ready back there yet? Did they come in? I believe they're piled back there on that back table. If you want to get one of those during the break, and you'll be able to follow along with me. If you have good eyesight, that is. They're very small.